It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Staying engaged and paying attention to what's going on in the world is important, but it can also take a toll. News fatigue is real. So as we close out this year of rising awareness of climate change, international tension, multiple refugee crises, constant political wrangling, and so many important but difficult stories, we are going to pause to focus on positive stories, acts of kindness, and connection this hour. And we're going to start with Rusty Johnson. He has dedicated much of his adult life to helping others, young people in foster care. He's a musician, a prevention specialist at YSS in Ames, and he's also a music teacher. The life he leads today would not have been possible without a few powerful acts of kindness in his childhood. Johnson grew up in Oskaloosa. His parents separated when he was in third grade. After that, his mother struggled with addiction, and he and his sisters wound up in foster care. He found his salvation through music and the investment of one of his foster mothers, and he is here with me now. Rusty, hello.
Hello, Charity. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And I want to talk a lot about the work that you do with foster kids today, but I think since you've been through so much in your life, telling us your story is going to help all of us understand what it feels like to enter the foster system. Can you take us back in time to when that first happened to you, what it was like to transition out of living with one of your biological parents to be in foster care?
Yeah, that's a hard question. I think for everybody it's different. For me, it was pretty chaotic when I first went into the foster care, so I'm not quite sure I knew normalcy, but I kind of knew it how I defined it. Which was just my surroundings. And when I first went in foster care, the first time was just for a really brief stint. They removed me from the home due to safety concerns. And I was put in a foster home for, again, just a couple of weeks. And at this point, we're talking, goodness, what, 25 years ago, reunification was the goal and should always be the goal. But at this point, it was a big emphasis of the state. And so they put me back home. That probably wasn't the best decision. And then I suffered a big bout of depression. And this was about, again, in goodness, second or third grade. And to be massively, clinically depressed in second or third grade, I remember just sitting on top of the stairs and just crying and crying. My sister didn't know what to do. I didn't know why I was crying. And I cried for about 8 hours straight. Nobody knew what to do. My sisters were struggling with their own battles at the time too, and nobody knew what to do. And I was hospitalized for depression, and so I was institutionalized for a bit, trying to figure out what to do with me. And I believe I was put back in my home again. Still didn't work out, and then that's when I entered back into the foster care system. And it was really weird to go from a life at that point I was leading where often I didn't go to school. There was big truancy issues. I preferred to ride my bike around town, swim in ponds, do things what I found fun, because there wasn't a lot of rules. There wasn't a lot of guidelines. So when I first went into this foster home, there was a lot of rules, a lot of structures. The foster parents had the absolute best intentions. It was a really religious home, which I thank, and I thank them to this day because it gave me the morals and the ethics that I have. But I wasn't used to that. And of course, like any kid would do, I rebelled. And I made their life pure chaos, they had two kids at that time, another one on the way. And they decided, this just wasn't the best fit for them. And that's how I started my journey into other foster homes. And at this time, the state was still pretty adamant about getting me back home. That's where they thought it was best. And thank goodness for the advocates later on in my life that would take a court stand and sit in front of the judge. And, even with my father out there and tell him, no, this is not the best home for Rusty to be put back into his biological home. That's not the best. It was a really tough thing for me to do, to even sit up on those court stands and look at my dad and say, no, I don't want to go home.
Yeah, what an ordeal for a child.
Yeah, and it was rough. And I'll never forget the time the judge slammed the gavel. This probably would have been about in sixth grade. He slammed the gavel and everybody was talking. Everybody was going crazy. And he said, stop, everybody, just stop. Rusty just wants to know where he's going to be for Christmas. And that was the first time it dawned on me. I didn't know where I was going to be for Christmas. It was just chaos. Everything was chaos, and I didn't know normalcy, so I didn't even know really how to define it.
You also had some very serious health struggles. It started when you were born, but then really developed in your teen years, right?
Yeah, yeah. I had what was misdiagnosed as hemangioma. And hemangioma is something, I don't want to say common, but it's like a collection of blood vessels that shouldn't be there. And typically it doesn't grow much bigger. And some people can live with it. Some people can have it removed. And in sixth grade, they decided to go ahead and try to remove it. This is when God was definitely looking over me. They still don't know how they removed that because it wasn't hemangioma. It ended up being something that's much more rare, which is called an AVM, or arterial venous malformation. And what they discovered was that I had a blood sac inside of me that was bigger than a hot water bottle. And it had wrapped itself around my heart and my lungs, and later scans would show that it was growing really rapidly, really massively. And this was at University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics, and even they hadn't seen anything like it. They didn't know what to do. And they were sending scans to, I believe it was Harvard and Boston. And again, a God thing, just by chance, a doctor there was being trained by the doctor who pioneered the procedure to operate on AVMs. And he gave him a call, and that doctor called my foster mom. And at that point, they had already given me pretty much a life expectancy because nobody knew what to do. And the doctor in Denver, Colorado, the one who pioneered the procedure, called my foster mom and said, how soon can you have him on a plane to Denver? And that started a process of surgeries and procedures, and that lasted up until even currently. It's been over about 30 surgeries and procedures, and my whole back's been reconstructed, and I'm happy to say I'm alive. Mm. It's been quite a journey.
So you were going through all of these health problems. Your relationship with your biological family was difficult. Your mother, as I mentioned earlier, struggled with addiction. She had tried to take her own life on multiple occasions. But I think it's important to just take a moment and let you talk about her, because I think with so many foster kids, when they come out of really difficult family situations, we forget about the emotional bonds that they still have with their family. I mean, you really, really loved your biological mother.
I can't express it enough. And I'll try not to get too choked up here. Sometimes I do, because my mom, you know, is still my mom, even though she's not here. And later on in life, when I started training foster parents, this was a chapter that hit really close home to me about even though kids can be removed from their biological parents are still their parents. And you have to remember, when kids are young, they don't see a lot of the chaos. And again, like I said, normalcy is normalcy. It's the only thing that you know. And with my mom, she was an addict. She struggled with a lot of different medical difficulties. But she was probably also the most beautiful person that ever walked this earth. She was the type that she would whistle to squirrels, and they would just come running up to her. Every single time we would be driving in the wood-paneled station wagon, you know, from the 80s, my dad would have to pull over the station wagon because there would be a cardinal outside, and we'd all have to get out and look at the cardinal, or we'd go look at the eagles, or we would, you know. She struggled with alcoholism. But that's where, you know, and she also struggled, I think, with a lot of prescription drugs. She struggled. And that's where addiction is something that truly is a disease that can affect the most beautiful people. And even where I work currently during the day, and I teach middle school and high school, that's something I convey to the kids, is that you may know addicts. You may know people that struggle doesn't mean that they're bad people. You know, just like my mother was. And unfortunately, it took her life with all the drugs and the alcohol. But perhaps that's part of what inspires me to do what I do.
You mentioned with your health struggles, the doctor called your foster mother, and that's a foster parent that I really want to talk to you about a little bit. Her name was Carolyn Brickley, and she was a music teacher in the North Mahaska School District. And she wasn't even somebody that you were supposed to be placed with. I mean, this was sort of a temporary fix to a situation that couldn't quite get figured out. Tell me a little bit about her. Do you remember your first encounter with her?
I do. You're right. I wasn't supposed to be placed with her. It was supposed to just be a temporary home. It was out of that first home that was that really structured religious home, and it just wasn't working out. They had decided to place me with another family that was trying to get licensed to take me. At the time, a vacation Bible school teacher who had befriended their daughter, and it was my very first friend. I'd never had friends before. And in the school district I was in Oskaloosa, I was just creating nothing but chaos. I was strangling kids in the coat closet. It was absolutely terrible. And the folks that were trying to get licensed to take me went to a different school district in North Mahaska, my new friend. And so thank goodness for the state of Iowa, they said, hey, Rusty likes this friend of his. Let's move him to the school district. The school year's starting up. Let's move him to that school district where his new friend is and give him a fresh start, give him a new chance.
You desperately need it. And now before you tell us about the first time you met Carolyn Brickley, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Rusty Johnson. He is a professional musician. He is a prevention specialist at YSS in Ames and teaches private music lessons. We're talking about the acts of kindness and connection that helped him get to where he is today. And we'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are focusing on stories of kindness and connection. Coming up in a few minutes, we're going to talk about a loving village that surrounds a family as they traverse divorce. We'll also find out about some really incredible work being done by the founders of the Humanize My Hoodie Project. But right now, my guest is Rusty Johnson. He is a musician. He's a prevention specialist with YSS in Ames. He works with children in foster care. He's a music teacher, and he grew up in foster care in Iowa. Without some pretty incredible acts of kindness in his childhood, he honestly wouldn't be here with us today. And Rusty, before the break, we had just gotten to the point where we were introducing your foster mother, one of your many foster parents, Carolyn Brickley. And she was a music teacher in the North Mahaska School District. So you were moving to a new school district. You were being placed with her temporarily while people who had planned to take you in were trying to get licensed as foster parents. So tell me about that first encounter with her, the story that she loves to tell.
Absolutely. So I guess as the story goes, I was sitting in the front yard of that first foster family, and she had pulled into the driveway, and she really didn't know what to expect. And she walked up, and I'm sitting in the front yard in a lawn chair reading a book. It sounds a little bit weird, but I guess that's what I like to do, is sit there and read traffic. And she walked up to me, and we looked eye to eye. Now, if anybody knows Miss Carolyn Brickley, she hasn't grown much since I'm telling this story. She's about 5'4", and that's in heels. A very, very small lady. And we looked eye to eye. And she says that from just talking to me that very first time, she knew that we clicked and that there was something special. And I went, she took me back to her house in New Sharon. And I was so excited because she introduced her rooms. She had three bedrooms, and she called them, I believe one was like the red room, one was the green room, one. And I thought, oh my goodness, I'm living in the White House. This is great. And at that time, I wasn't involved in music. I didn't know that she was the elementary music teacher. She had a lot of cats. She was a single lady. She had a yard that I could play in, and she was the teacher. And that was really weird to be enrolled in a school district where suddenly everybody called me Miss Brickley's son. That everybody knew that Miss Brickley suddenly miraculously had a son, and there I was. And it was a fresh start. It was new. I didn't have that negative stereotype just hanging over me, or that negative connotation of Rusty the foster kid, everything was new. I even remember sitting on the playground being so scared to open up my mouth because I was afraid I would mess up. I was afraid I'd screw up and say something that somebody didn't like, and that then nobody would like me and I'd go back down that path. So things just drastically changed from that moment on.
And one of the first things she did was offer to give you music lessons.
Yeah, and I did not know that. That was something, I think maybe one of the last gifts that my biological mom gave me. It was during a supervised visit, I believe shortly before Christmas, and there had been a saxophone that had been in the family that one of my older sisters played. And after my mom died, we found out she had very, very few possessions. Why she kept on to the saxophone or held on to it, I don't know. But she held on to the saxophone, and she had already called Miss Brickley and arranged that if she would give me that saxophone during a supervised visit in Ottumwa, if she would give that to me, would Miss Brickley teach me music lessons? And I didn't want to play saxophone. I had no interest at that time. I still read the letters from my mom to this day, and she says, you know, I hope you're practicing the saxophone. I just wish you would give it a shot. You know, I want you to become Kenny G. She loved Kenny G, the saxophone player. And Miss Brickley had agreed, and I took that saxophone, and still to this day, Miss Brickley says I was probably the worst student she's ever had out of thousands of students. I had no rhythm. I had no beat. I'd be downstairs in the basement trying to practice. And of course, she's the music teacher. She's upstairs doing dishes. And I'd hear the whole ceiling shake to the rhythm of what I was supposed to be playing in the lesson books because I just could not get it.
And she was trying to just beat it into your head.
She was
through
trying. But she, uh-huh. I was a difficult student.
But it turns out that you had an ear.
I did. And again, one of her very favorite stories to share is, and I remember parts of it, and, you know, especially after my mom died, you know, after my mom took her life, I took to the saxophone, and Kenny G was my mom's favorite, and so I started listening to Kenny G, and North Mahaska, and that was one of the best things that could have happened to me is to move me to North Mahaska, because it was a small school. I could get one-on-one attention. They had a soprano saxophone, which is what Kenny G plays. It's a specialized instrument. So they loaned me the soprano saxophone, and I think Miss Brickley had something to do with that. And she even bought me my first soprano saxophone. I had a choice pretty much between a car or a soprano saxophone, and I chose the soprano saxophone. And I took that and would put Kenny G on the radio and start playing along with him, trying to figure out the notes, what he was playing. And Miss Brickley walked by the room once, and she loves to tell the story about how she heard two Kenny G's playing, and she couldn't figure out what was happening, and opened up the door and asked me, "What are you doing, Rusty?" And I said, "Well, I'm playing with Kenny G," and she asked how I was doing it. And to me, it was just picking out a note, you know, figuring out what note he was playing, trying to figure it out. And I think it was probably a week or two after that she enrolled me in some private music lessons, which is part of what inspired me to start teaching private music lessons.
It really transformed your life. And
we
don't have time to, you have so much more to your story, and we don't have time to share everything that happened. But I do want to ask you, you didn't stay with Carolyn Brickley. It wasn't a forever happy ever after kind of story. But as an adult, she adopted you. She is your mother now.
She is.
And
she is.
You asked her to adopt you as an adult. Why was that important to you, even though so many years had passed?
Yeah, I was 37 years old when I sent her the text message. It was important because I guess as a foster child, that might be one of the most vulnerable things you can do. And even though it's something that's just on paper, that is, I think, the ultimate sign of commitment, of that unconditional type of love that I'm looking for and that I want to give, that I wanted to give to her. And even though we had become estranged and then we had reconnected after I'd moved through different foster homes, you know, I sent her the text when I was playing and living out in Los Angeles, California. And I think I pretty much asked, why did you never adopt me? And she said she remembers asking me once and just the fear on my face alone told her I wasn't ready. And then she sent a text back and said, why are you asking me? And I got scared. I didn't know. And I something came inside of me and I texted back and said, well, yes, I am. And then she didn't get back. And I was so scared. Probably 10 minutes passed. And I found out later on, I think she was crying. And she said she had been waiting 20 years for that question. And I even after that's part of why I moved back to Iowa, was that's family. I mean, this is family, and it's a new chapter. It's a new beginning, even at 37 years old. And I didn't get adopted until I was, goodness, I believe it was, I got adopted when I was 38. I think I asked her when I was about 35, but got adopted on my birthday,
wow.
July 28th at Mahaska County Courthouse. And it's so important just to have that unconditional commitment, that I know she knows me. I know she knows, and I know she loves me. And there's nothing that can change that.
Tell me, you do so much work with foster kids now, and I think anybody can understand why that's important, because you wouldn't be here without Carolyn Brickley and other caring people. But what do you want people to know about the foster system? There are so many kids involved in the foster system.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, and I work with various organizations and something I want folks to know is that right here in Iowa, we have over 800 kids that are in the foster care. Well, we have, I believe it's like 5,000 kids in the foster care, but 800 of those are eligible for adoption. They're free. They're, I mean, as far as willing and ready on paper to be adopted, and they need homes, these kids. And to adopt out of foster care is often a price tag of $0. There's organizations out there that can even help reimburse the minimal costs of that. But even if you can't adopt and you can't foster, I mean, I'm not a foster parent, I'm not an adoptive parent, but just to get involved, every single person that's listening right now, I can promise you there's something that you can do to help out these kids. It takes a village. It's, you know, they didn't ask for this situation. And I know often people don't necessarily ask to help them out or ask to, but every single, even the smallest acts can make such a difference in a kid's life. The teacher that took me to Bonanza in Oskaloosa when I finally got a C- on a paper because that was better than a D or an F, you know, and she knew I was struggling. And even that, those little things that you can do to help kids that are at risk or kids that are struggling, help them find out what's positive in their life that they can go after instead of, you know, leaning towards, you know, instead of them leaning towards the negative and getting the reinforcement through the negative way, help them to find out what their passion is. Help them if they're in music, dance, theater, sports, camps, whatever it is, that they get that positive reinforcement. Help be their cheerleader. And just get involved, help volunteer.
Rusty Johnson, he is a musician. He's a prevention specialist with YSS in Ames and a private music teacher. He also sits on the board of the nonprofit Iowans for Adoptions. You can find out more about how to get involved at iowansforadoptions.org. This hour, we're focusing on acts of kindness and connection. And this next story sounds like a tragedy, the end of a marriage. But it's actually a story about caring adults doing their best in a tough situation and the loving people that make up their village. Anne Craig is here with me. She lives in Lisbon, Iowa, and she spent the last 3 months navigating a divorce. Hello, Anne.
Hello.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
And I know this is an incredibly personal subject, but I want to ask you, to go back 3 months in time and tell me just a little bit about what you were feeling and thinking as you started to navigate this process.
Yeah, so it was a big step, obviously, for both of us. And we wanted to do it in the best way for our children. We have two young kids, and they were at the forefront. I also have some stepchildren that I care very deeply about and wanted to keep in my life. So kind of navigating how can we communicate in the best way that we can and plan for the future and still be a team moving forward was really important to both of us. You know, even in a situation where we understood our different sides, but we weren't necessarily on the same page about that.
A lot of us know people, all of us know people who've gone through divorce, and a lot of us know people who've gone through really ugly, difficult divorces. Did you have role models of sort of a positive divorce experience that you were able to look to as you started this process?
Sure. I mean, the first one was my parents. My parents got divorced when I was a senior in high school, and we still have family Christmases together. And, you know, I watched them continue to get along, and there was never fighting or any of that. So, I mean, that is a huge one. There was also a coworker at school who ended up e-filing for her own divorce and not using a lawyer, which at the time I didn't even know that was a thing, that you could just decide together and agree on things together and save a lot of hassle and hard
and
feelings
money.
And money for sure was a big factor. But talking to her about that experience, as well as, you know, knowing there were people in my own life who were able to get through this and still get along and do what's best for everybody.
We throw around the phrase, it takes a village, all the time. But it feels so true here that you have this loving village around you and your children and your stepchildren and your ex-husband and his ex-wife. I mean, what a really loving, caring community that has shown up for you in this difficult time. That's really special.
Yeah, it's really special. I feel very blessed to have all of those people in my life and to continue to grow the village, you know, like we can just keep adding more to the family. There's no rules now.
Right. How has this experience and all of these people showing up for you and the people that you care about, how has that changed or made you think about who you are in the lives of other people?
That's a really good question. I think a big part of it is just taking away the titles and like what role you're supposed to play, and just getting down to the basics of get to know somebody. Like that's all you got to do is listen and talk and share and be present. You know, at the end of the day, everybody's just people and you can just get to know them for who they are.
There, I think, as you said, it's kind of a taboo subject. But I think part of the reason that it's a taboo subject is that people feel shame about it. Although more than half of all marriages results in divorce in this day and age. Did you wrestle with that? Did you feel ashamed to bring it up and tell people that this is what was happening with your family?
I don't know if I felt ashamed. I mean, definitely there's some guilt, I think, of like, you know, you're putting your family through this big process, much of which is not good, even if you strongly believe the end result will be good. But the transition period can definitely be a struggle. Maybe not shame, but definitely some guilt there that, you know, you kind of have to go through and deal with.
Do you have the feeling that, I don't know, that maybe we're getting better at navigating divorce? Are we getting better at being caring adults in this hard situation?
I hope so. I mean, I'm hearing more stories. My parents were the first people I knew who went through a divorce and were still getting together for family events. And that was 20 years ago. And I'm hearing more and more about it now. You know, we're already making traditions. You know, we will all get together Christmas morning with our whole blended family. We've told our kids that every birthday it's a non-negotiable. They get to see all their parents. And so I think it is getting better. I think it's less taboo the more people talk about it and share their stories and share what's possible and kind of take away all this negative, angry stuff that can often come with that situation.
Anne, thank you so much for sharing your story with me.
Thank you.
Anne Craig lives in Lisbon, Iowa. This hour, we're talking about acts of kindness and connection. And coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with the founders of the Humanize My Hoodie Project. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. 3 years ago, when Andre Wright and Jason Soule started the Humanize My Hoodie Project, it was born out of the need to make a statement following the death of Trayvon Martin. Soule, who's a criminal justice professor, decided to wear a hooded sweatshirt, like the one Martin was wearing when he was shot, to teach his classes all semester long. Wright is an entrepreneur and a fashion designer, owner of Born Leaders United, and the two teamed up to create the Humanize My Hoodie Project, selling hooded sweatshirts designed to start conversations and to help people realize that the person inside each hoodie is a human being, regardless of the color of their skin, their societal perspectives, or their fashion sense. The project has grown dramatically with multiple art exhibitions, anti-racism workshops, a pop-up fashion show at New York City's Fashion Week, and now a beautiful new book and documentary. But most importantly, through all of this, Wright and Soule have found themselves really connecting with people, educating people, empowering people, and changing lives. They are both here with me now. Welcome back to the show, guys.
Well, thank you for having us. Wow, that was an amazing intro. Like, I almost dropped a tear on that one.
Well, you guys are doing such incredible work. And this book that you've just published, the Humanize My Hoodie Movement book, you're calling it a graphic novel. I'm not sure about that. It's a gorgeous photographic journey through all of this with these really beautiful pictures, empowering pictures of people of color, most of them wearing Humanize My Hoodie sweatshirts. It's really beautiful, but it also speaks to all of these individuals that you have touched over these 3 years. And Jason, why don't I start with you? Because one of the great things in this book, you have published these responses of your students to your experiment that semester where you wore a hooded sweatshirt to class every day and you ask them how they feel about seeing a black man in a hooded sweatshirt. What did they say that surprised you?
I mean, I wouldn't say I was surprised. I knew their biases would show up in the work. I already knew that going into it. I mean, some of them, you know, they were happy when they walked in and saw, one of the quotes says, "I was happy when I saw a black man teaching the class instead of a white man, but I also questioned whether or not he was the teacher." So they was happy they saw somebody black teaching the course, but then they also wondered, like, is this the actual teacher for the class? So, I mean, we got raw responses, and we didn't put everything in the book, but we wanted to show you what some students thought when they saw me in my hoodie teaching the course. So, I mean, a lot of it said, when you have on a hoodie, I think you're lazy. I think you don't care about life. That's very interesting to be able to capture that information. So I'm glad I was able to put the quotes in there. And Andre definitely brought the images to life where the words jump off the page. So we learned a lot from doing this experiment.
Absolutely. Well, and you also asked those students the same questions at the end of the semester. And you really did see change, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They said they had to check themselves just on a consistent basis, even outside of class. And I didn't, you know, I wasn't prepared to hear things like that, but they couldn't turn it off once we came into the class. Many of them said, man, having on a hoodie and you being a black person, it threw me off. You know, I've never had, like many of them had never had a black professor. So to have one with a hoodie, you know, that's like, you know, they almost traumatized from the experience. But no, they all left. They all left okay, and they're much better people as a result.
Well, we've talked several times over the years about this project and about the very serious societal problems that you're responding to with this project. But Andre, I would love for you to reflect a little bit. I mean, this started out with a big statement and some cool hooded sweatshirts, but you in addition to selling sweatshirts and educating people, you've also been raising money to donate sweatshirts to young people, but you've been having conversations with those kids too. And recently, you just donated a bunch of sweatshirts. Both of you guys were involved in this and donating a bunch of sweatshirts to kids in Waterloo after there was an incident where somebody made some racist comments at a city council meeting about what kids look like when they're wearing hooded sweatshirts. And so you got into the schools and you talked to these kids. Can you tell me about that experience?
I think, with the work that we do as far as the giveaways is, and this extension of the work that Jason and I had already been doing, mm-hmm. as far as like being in the schools and working with our youth and just empowering them in all kinds of ways. So this was just an added layer.
Yeah.
And when we started them initially, obviously this is coming from a place of love and a place of where we want to just give back. And initially when we started giving out the hoodies, we didn't know what the response was going to be. We were like, oh, this feels good. This is a great thing. But after we started to have those conversations with the students, they started to tell us stories about what the hoodie did for them, or how they were able to have a conversation with someone based on what the hoodie, those three words, humanize my hoodie, said. And so as we were doing our research and understanding what the hoodie actually did, we understood that the power that that garment had, and just by the kids having it on, how much powerful they were, you know. And so when the gentleman made the remark, you know, about the hooded sweatshirt in Waterloo, our initial reaction was like, okay, we got to arm all the kids with hoodies. You know, it's time to really do the movement stuff. And it wasn't about it looking good or whatever. It was about, hey, we got to arm the community with hoodies. They hurting and they need these items to really express who they really are, you know. So we grateful and fortunate that we're in a position to be able to do that. I mean, we gave away 275 hoodies. That's a pretty, you know, heavy number of hoodies to be circulating around small Waterloo, which is my hometown and Jason's, you know, high school. He went to high school in Waterloo, so, and that's where we met. So it was very special, very emotional, very sentimental. We had all the community leaders come out. Everybody gave a speech. We had a healing circle. We just did a lot of amazing things with those youth that they had never even experienced before. So we were just honored and grateful to be able to bring that to that space.
Well, and both of you had to be thinking back to when you were students.
For real,
in
yeah.
Waterloo. So, Jason, I mean, take us back to thinking about what it would have meant to you when you were in high school in Waterloo if somebody like you had come in and given this empowering message to you. What do you think you would have felt? What would that have meant?
So for me, if I would have had someone come back, it would have meant the world. And I know how it is in life. Some people move away and start families and things like that, but it's always important to come back and say, we haven't forgotten about you. We graduated from Waterloo East High. We dealt with racism in the schools, outside of the schools, everywhere. But we fighting against it if we want to come back and just show y'all some love. So it's super emotional, but it's empowering. They go on to do greater things. We're seeing it.
Andre, what think about yourself in high school? What would that have meant to you?
I think I was pretty, I wouldn't say I was shy in high school, but I wasn't very outspoken. I used my outspokenness in, you know, art form, I guess. I think it would have might have gave me a voice. I think that act of what we did gave a lot of kids the opportunity to see that they actually do have a voice and they could say something. I think I would have had a stronger voice if I would have seen that happen to me in high school, you know.
What an incredible gift. And how does that change how you feel when you can do that, when you can have this interaction with a student and see them light up, Andre?
It makes me say we got to do more. Like, and it just can't be me and Jason. We need, you know, support so we can not just do it in, you know, Waterloo and Iowa or, you know, in Minnesota, but I mean, nationwide, this is a thing that we should be doing everywhere.
Well, you guys have been hearing from other people who have gotten really excited about what you're doing. In fact, you've got some celebrities who've jumped in on the Humanize My Hoodie movement. John Legend is one of those, shared a great Instagram post about Humanize My Hoodie. How does that feel, Jason, to see that catching on like that, to see people all over the country really saying, hey, I want to be part of this?
Man, it's humbling, man. Like, we try not to think about it too much because it'll probably make us start treating people differently. So we kind of, we appreciate it. We talk about it, we vibe on it, and just, you know, really revel in it, because he didn't have to do that, but it helped us, and it made other people see us. Kind of how when we give hoodies away, we help the kids be seen. That's what John Legend did for us, so we grateful for it. I mean, if we ever get a chance to meet him, we definitely going to thank him in person, but, I mean, he didn't have to do that. So for him to do that for us, we're grateful, truly grateful.
I want to talk about your anti-racism workshops that have grown out of the Humanize My Hoodie movement. And I mean, Andre, when you started this, the workshops weren't part of the plan.
No,
were they?
I don't believe so. But Jason's a trainer. He's been doing this work for a long time. So, you know, this was part of me supporting him and saying, hey, I trust you with this, and I want to learn too. And so I learned a lot along the way. And now you can consider me a trainer too.
Absolutely. You co-training. Yep. You co-training, absolutely. But we wanted to be inclusive. You know, like a lot of programs talk about diversity and inclusion, but we actually created a way for white allies to be a part of this movement and to be a critical part of it. So the training to help them deal with implicit bias, it helps with accountability. We talk about threat perception. We give them education in it. You know, these are four-hour trainings. So it wasn't on Andre's radar, but we're, what, 10 trainings in, 10 workshops in, over 300 people trained. So he got his swagger back with the training.
No doubt. I got a notch in my belt.
Well, absolutely.
When people come to these workshops, Jason, the people who come through the door of the workshop, I mean, they're there because their hearts are in the right place. But through this training, I'm sure every single person who walks through that door learns so much, and they have their perspectives shifted, and they learn a lot about how they move through the world. What's that like when you see that light bulb go off for somebody, when all of a sudden they realize, oh, this is more than what I thought. This is different than what I thought.
I mean, in those moments, we feel like we're uplifting humanity. We feel like we might have made somebody safer as a result of this workshop. When they light up, that means maybe they'll prevent me from getting killed by law enforcement in the streets. Maybe they will step up in a restaurant and speak on my behalf if somebody's giving me poor service because of my black skin. So when those moments happen, we feel like we actually have a better chance at liberation for black people. So we're overwhelmed when we see that, because it's like, wow, man, this person got it. They understand it. They know what they need to do to be an ally. Because for me, I'm empathetic to all people. My heart is there. A lot of our allies need to get out of their heads and go to their hearts, and they leave there much better people really doing the work, like, every day. So we're grateful for our allies.
Absolutely. Andre, just reflect on those moments that you see. Sort of, I mean, you get to see epiphanies. People just understand their world a lot better.
Yeah. I mean, the allies are so important to our movement. When we're talking about liberation of black folks, this is, you know, part of the work. You know, just to touch back on what Jason was saying about what they do for black people is, with our training, we're able to help them understand that, you know, it can't just be all white people in corporate America either. We're giving black folks access, because that person that's in our training is probably someone who has a corporate job or a better position in life than most of us. So it's opening doors and giving people access and letting us have a seat at the table and letting us say, hey, we want equity.
We've been focusing this hour on acts of kindness and connection. And through the Humanize My Hoodie movement, you guys have created so many of these amazing moments. You have committed acts of kindness and created these moments of connection. But I'm curious, have you been surprised by the kindness that you've encountered. I mean, this movement was born out of a terrible crisis in our country, a really dark time. Have you been surprised by what you've encountered, Andre?
I wouldn't say surprised, but I've been not shocked or anything like that. I've been open to whatever the universe has to offer us, you know, and accepting of the gifts. And I believe that because we're doing the work, people see that and they want to support it. And I think, you know, any human being that sees anyone doing anything, we should support anything, you know, like in regards to actually doing the work. So I think people see us doing the work and they want to support it. And man, we're grateful for that.
This book that you have published together contains all these really beautiful images. You've collected quotes from so many people. Some of them are inspiring. Some of them are just mind-opening quotes that really have the power to touch people and transform. What does it mean to you to have this really beautiful book come out of your work to create this together and release it into the world, Andre?
You know, as I'm staring at the cover, you know, this is that photo that we're looking at is a photo from New York Fashion Week, and you know, this book is a journey through, you know, the harm that's been caused to the black body, the harm that the hoodie, when the hoodie is put on the black body, what's the harm? Then it goes through the history of the hoodie. Then it starts to liberate black folks. And at the same time, we got the ally stories in there, and they're talking about how, so it's really a case study up to, you know, when we start talking about the humanize my hoodie movement. And then when we get into the movement piece, it's like showing you all these different ways that we've actually humanized people. So I look at this book, and I, as it sits on this table, it's a masterpiece. It's literally a masterpiece. And I'm you know, I'm honored and grateful. Again, this is my first time ever publishing a book. So anybody who's listening and is a dreamer or a believer or maybe even a doubter of themselves, they can look at that and say, hey, I think I can do that, you know, or I think I can do something that I said I probably didn't feel like I can do, but I feel like I can do it now, just based off the fact that they've seen me and Jason and myself put this together.
It's been incredible to watch you guys over the last 3 years and to talk with you. I mean, you're both extraordinary men, but the momentum of this movement has been really something powerful to behold, and I cannot wait to see where you guys go with this.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate that.
Jason Soul teaches at Hamline University in Minneapolis. Andre Wright lives in Iowa City. He's the founder of Born Leaders United, and together they started the Humanize My Hoodie Project. Their new book, Humanize My Hoodie Movement, and a documentary short, Road to the New York Fashion Week, have just been released. This hour, we've been talking about acts of kindness and connection. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Happy holidays.